sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets post small losses for the week, but volatility spikes. The Herbalife saga continues. Yellen speaks at Jackson Hole and says, not much. And our guest today, Kirk Duplessis. He's with Option Alpha. He talks about options and Greeks and strangles and naked puts and all sorts of great things. All this and much more on episode number 473 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host. And so for the last, 8 years or so, maybe close to 9 years at this point, one of the original podcasts on finance. If you've been tracking me for a long time, we've been here with some great guests, some topics that are very timely, as well as some educational materials that will hopefully get you to be a better investor, whether you're long-term minded, swing trading, day trading, or somewhere in between. We hopefully have a lot here for you. I spent a lot of time trying to find some guests that could bring us some new and interesting information. And this week, I think we're going to have something of interest because we haven't talked about the whole idea of, or the concept or the topic of options for some time. But I wanted to give you a couple things. First of all, some of the information you can find on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The website has some of the show notes, the links to the various guests. There's a great place that you can find a really great filter. If you go over to the Disciplined Investor on top, it says podcast search and filter, and there's a variety of different things in there. One of the things that you can do on the site is actually filter by guest, filter by stock symbol. And you can see, for example, if you want to listen to a particular guest that's been on and see when they've been on, you can actually do a filtering for that guest. And it talks about the topics that they talked about, the date they were on, and play that podcast right from that window or that filter. So that's a kind of a cool thing on the Disciplined Investor. And of course, if you have any questions, you can always contact me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's get right into some of the topics that really were moving markets last week. And I know a lot of you had been thinking about, well, what is Yellen going to say now? She spoke at the Friday meeting of Jackson Hole in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where they have an annual gathering of economists and analysts and all sorts of central bankers. There was a slew of central bankers speaking about all sorts of things. Well, everybody really wanted to see what was going on with Yellen. What was she going to say? Is she going to say something different? Is she going to talk about the potential for a rate hike? Is it more likely? Is she going to be more hawkish? And she came out in the discussion and mentioned the case for an increase in the Fed funds rate has strengthened in recent months. And initially, markets saw that as a very hawkish statement from her. And when you look at what she said, though, underneath, beyond the headlines and all that, when you look at the actual transcript of her speech, she was still as dovish as ever, talking about $2 trillion of monies can be used for quantitative easing and bond purchases in the future for other types of downturns and really hedging her whole discussion there. So once again, thinking that the central banks would come to reality of where we are in the economic cycle and say already it's time to start to truly normalize the rates, you know, they're not going to do it because they have a $4 or so trillion book of business that is invested in bonds that they want to keep at these high levels. In addition to that, they also realize that by increasing the rate, it's going to cause the U.S. government to have to pay more money on the bonds that are going to be issued, not the ones that are outstanding because those are done already, but because they're doing this constant purchasing of bonds with the interest payments that come due as well as the maturity values that come due, no new money at this point, but just reinvesting everything, the U.S. government would have to issue bonds at a higher rate. And as such, what does that mean? Well, that's going to cost the U.S. government more money. And in the end, who is the U.S. government? Well, it's you and me. It's us. And then markets realized that, well, things are, you know, kind of came in a bit. And I think markets were up something like 50 basis points at that point. And then Yellen spoke and it came in. Then it went back up. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, good news. And then Stanley Fisher came out and was much more hawkish comparably to what had been said by Janet Yellen. And markets got pretty pissed off about that, although finished just ever so slightly down because we had the usual last 45 minutes of the trading day push everything right back up. Now, we'll see how that plays out because the dollar did, in fact, strengthen. Still not terribly high, but again, all of the strengthening of the dollar is negative for U.S. equities. We know that. So one of the things we're going to keep a look at is what's going to happen with earnings and how many of these companies, as I mentioned 100 times, if not once, are going to start talking about constant currency basis types of earnings. Now, we did see on the economic front, new home sales blew out. It was just a blowout. It was incredible. As a matter of fact, it was a 12.5% increase in new home sales from the month before. And it was almost at a 9-year peak. And we have a 4.3-month new home inventory available. Now, on the other side, we saw the National Association of Realtors come out with their existing home sales, and that actually slipped 3.2%. Inventory was down about 6%. And we did see the median sale price was about $244,000, which is about 5.5% better than it was a year ago. Now, on top of that, another thing that I thought was interesting last week, it looks like maybe some of the negative presidential campaigning, some of the Brexit talk, some of the things that are going on in the economy are starting to worry consumers. University of Michigan came out with their gauge of consumer sentiment, and the final number came out at 89.8, which was less than the 90.5, which was the preliminary reading that we saw. They kind of keep on revising it. And the one thing that was really high in that, if you look at it, was the assessment of current economic conditions, which is at a pretty much a high ever, or a recent high of 107. So the current conditions, everybody's saying, oh, everything's fine. It's the outward. They're like, I'm not quite sure. And that brought it down considerably. Now, for the week, as I mentioned, stocks closed lower. Nothing major, but we did see the GDP come in pretty lousy. 1.1% was the estimate for the second quarter growth. And, that didn't really sway markets much. As a matter of fact, I'd probably say that helped markets sustain a bid, thinking that the government and the central bank's going to be like, well, you can't get GDP moving. Well, we'll have to stay sticking to our guns of buying bonds and doing what we do. Dow Jones finished down about 0.85% lower, NASDAQ 0.37, and the S&P about 0.7% lower for the week. I think it was the first week in, I think, 8 that the NASDAQ was down. Kind of interesting. Now, what do we have coming up before we get to our guest? Well, on Monday, investors will look at the July personal spending report. And on Tuesday, the Conference Board's August Consumer Confidence Index and the Case-Shiller Home Price Index for June. We'll see earnings from Abercrombie & Fitch, DSW, the shoe store, H&R Block, and a important and well-watched name in the cybersecurity area, Palo Alto Networks. Now, Wednesday, we're going to have ADP come out with their employment, which is the precursor to the Friday employment number from the government. We'll see what's going on there. I'm still looking at the 200 range or 175 or so. That's what everybody's expecting. We're going to see on Thursday. I got a couple of nothing major on Wednesday. On Thursday, we'll see the job cut report, ISM August manufacturing. We'll see initial claims and earnings from Broadcom, Campbell Soup, Land's End, Lululemon, Smith & Wesson, and Verifone. And Friday, the big thing on Friday is clean the slate for everything because we have the Department of Labor is coming out with their August jobs report. Now, if that's going to be strong again, like we've seen the last several, you have to think that, you know, the central bank's going to be like, you know, we got to possibly look to raise rates here because we've hit, as we've said and we've commented, we've hit our targets basically here. We're not happy with the targets. We should have had higher targets, but we're happy with the targets. Or we've hit the targets, I should say. Now, they'll make all sorts of reasons why, as I mentioned earlier, they're not going to raise and they're not going to do. But in the end, the bottom line is that, you know, they're going to be forced to at least probably raise. I think they're going to be forced to raise at least once by the end of the year. That is not going to make anybody happy. It's going to probably move the dollar up again, as it did last year in the beginning of the year. Or towards the end of the year, the dollar was really ramping up in anticipation of a rate hike. Now, whether or not they do it at the September meeting, the December meeting, maybe they'll just figure, well, last year worked out just fine. Yeah, there was a big dip afterwards, but the markets came back and were very resilient. Maybe we'll just follow the script from last year where we raised it the last month and kind of everything played out just fine. And at least we know that we have some kind of a template for what will happen potentially. I don't know. Anyway, with that, we'll see what happens. I mean, but unfortunately, we are tied into a discussion about central banks. It's unfortunate because it really takes the focus off some of the other things that are important. And we all know, I think at this point, that the distortions that are being created by the central bank because of their desire to keep everything going in this, you know, on this treadmill, it's kind of like and keep investors with the carrot in front of them to invest because of low interest rates and hoping that this is going to, you know, bring on a resurgence in economic activity, which it hasn't not only here, but it hasn't even around the world with lower rates. So it is just part of the discussion right now. And I look forward to the day that it's not. I tell you right now, I totally look forward to the day that we are not talking continually about the central banks, but we'll have to leave that to another time. Right now, we're going to get to our guest. And our guest today is Kirk Duplessis, and he is with Option Alpha. And yes, we're going to talk about options today because this is something we don't talk about very often. It's an area that I know a lot of people are interested in, but yet a lot of people don't have a lot of understanding, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So, Kirk, we're going to do our best to give him a little bit of information and bring him up to speed. How's that sound?
We're going to deliver. I like it. Let's do it.
So let's start out basically with a couple of things. Now, I know you have a you know, you have a, it's, I guess, educational with a blog, with kind of a service as well with regard to showing people what you're actually trading and helping them along. But let's start out with first, what kind of options do you trade?
Yeah, so it's all equity options. So we do very few, I would say like almost no futures options, but it's all equity options, pretty much anything that anybody can trade. So options on stocks that are listed on the exchanges.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's start out with a very basic question, okay? And then we'll kind of graduate from there. What is an option?
Yeah, so an option contract is just, the fancy name is it's a derivative contract, but you really want to think about it as like the simplest place to, or simplest way to think about it is an insurance contract. And that's usually like the easiest way to relate. So like when somebody buys a house, they might, you know, buy an insurance policy on that house in case it burns down. And so that insurance policy derives its value from the house that's being protected or that contract is on.
Right.
And so the same thing in the options market. Options contracts are just financial instruments that derive their value from the underlying asset that it's being traded on.
So when we look at options, and you can say, you know, on whatever stock that may be, there's different pricing, but it derives its value on not only the price and the underlying price of it, but also there's a few other components that go into how the price is actually then created, right?
Yep. So I think that the rub is that when people get into options trading, it's not one dimensional, right? So like everyone gets into stock trading and they understand it, right? The price of Apple is the price of Apple, like shares or whatever the price are. But when you deal with option contracts, just like insurance contracts on a house or car or motorcycle, whatever, there's a lot more variables, right? So in the case of options trading, some of the variables are how much time until expiration do I have, right? Because you can write option contracts that are 7 days out. I mean, literally 7 day contracts. You can do them for 30 days. You can do them for a year, 2 years. Warren Buffett does them for 20 years. So you can do them based on all these different timeframes. And the longer the time frame, generally the more expensive the contract or the more value the contract's going to have. And then other things go into consideration like, okay, well, how far is the stock going to move, or how much, you know, volatility is the stock expected to have in the future? So like, so those are the other key things that kind of go into an options price. And so it's not one dimensional. It's, you know, a little bit more, you know, that goes into it, and it's not rocket science to understand, but it does take a little bit of extra effort, you know, on the part of most investors to understand it.
So one of the things I always say about options is that the thing about options that people have to understand is that you have to be right twice. And maybe even more if you want to get into some of the other things like volatility, et cetera. But you have to be right twice. You have to be right in direction, and you have to be right in time. Because one of the things you didn't bring up was, I think an important component, is that options have a definitive time. You mentioned long-term, of course, you know, but most people are not buying options for 20 years. They're not even buying options for a year. They're, you know, doing it for maybe 3 or 4 months out, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, you have to be right in a couple different areas, and it depends on the way that you trade options, right? Like, so when you're trading stocks, you have to be right in the direction, and there's, you've got a lot of time on your side. You can hold, you know, shares theoretically for as long as they're going to be around until you're right. And with an options contract, you have an expiration date. So it's kind of like make it or break it by this date. But you also have to be right, I think, on volatility. And like, yeah, that to me is like the big part that people don't really, really grasp. And because that's where your edge really lies. And what I believe in to be your edge in options trading is in that volatility aspect. And you have to understand where volatility is, because if the market assumes that this stock is going to make a really big move and it doesn't make that big move, then maybe you overpaid for an option contract that you thought was going to make you, you know, a ton of money, and it didn't end up working out. So right. I think the directional aspect is kind of a moot point, to be honest with you. Like, I think, yeah, you have to be right in directions, but you can trade options on a neutral basis. You can create a strategy that's non-directional and that's pretty neutral. So as long as the market stays range bound or the stock stays range bound, you can make money. And that, like, personally, that's the way I like to trade, is like a lot more of that neutral, non-directional aspect. Because I'm not really good at picking stocks. I'm not ever been good at picking stocks. And I don't think many people are. And you just have to accept that fact.
But one of the things now, so, you know, we talk about time. We talk about underlying security. We talk about volatility, all these things that go into it. And a lot of times in the option world and in the vernacular of option players, a lot of these different things, they have different words for this, right? They're the Greeks.
Sure.
So can you kind of go through some of the basics, you know, like, maybe Vega and Delta and all the different things that maybe, you know, that may be involved, which people are going to see when they start looking at option screens in terms of what options are on their, whatever their platform is they're using. They're going to see these kinds of things on there.
Yeah. So I think really you want to break it down into two like main categories. And the two main categories that you have to break it down into are intrinsic value and extrinsic value of that contract. And when I say intrinsic value, it's like, what is the value of that contract if it were to be exercised or be assigned today? So like I say, like, what's the in the money value right now that you have on these contracts? And just to even like tangent off real quick, yeah, it's a lot of like jargon, but I mean, look, in every business, every profession, like I get a lot of people email me and they're like, oh, it's just so much jargon. I'm like, yeah, like it's takes a little bit of time to understand. But look, driving a car took a little bit of time to understand too, right? You didn't jump behind the wheel and know what everything was.
Right.
So it's intrinsic value and then extrinsic value. When you look at things like intrinsic value, it's mostly comprised of things like delta and then gamma. And all delta and gamma really show, because option Greeks don't forecast pricing. They just kind of show you like what the actual like, you know, positioning is at the moment that you're looking at it. And so delta and gamma just show you how much money, you know, could potentially be made if the stock goes up by a dollar or if the stock goes down by a dollar. I mean, we could probably do an hour long conversation on it, but it's really just showing you like that denominal factor of how much money that contract should make for a dollar move up or a dollar move down in the stock. And that's really linear. Like most people understand that aspect of it. When you get into the extrinsic value side of an option contract, that's the future forecasted, you know, volatility and time aspect. So that's where your theta, which is your time decay, and that's really easy for me always to understand because like T for theta, T for time decay. Mm-hmm. And then you have vega, which is your volatility. So again, V for vega, V for volatility. And so now you have this extra component that's, you know, really looking at the future impact of time and volatility at the same time. And that's that extrinsic or external, you know, factor. So how much time do I have until expiration? If you've got a lot of time, generally that means that the contract is going to be worth more money because you have a lot of time for the thing to move potentially into a profitable zone. If volatility is really high on that stock, meaning the stock's making huge swings every single day or every single week, then that option contract is going to be worth more money again, because that means that there's a better chance that the stock swings into a profitable zone versus if the stock is really low volatility and really doesn't swing into a profitable zone. Like a, you know, like most, you know, of the, like the big Dow Jones industrial companies, right, like the GEs and everything, they're low volatility and people, there's a place for those, but those option contracts around those securities don't generally have a lot of value because the stock doesn't move that much.
Now, do you find yourself, one of the ways you look for opportunities is to find irregularities or opportunity from maybe some mispricing? Is that something that you look for and search for?
So I think there's two different things here. So like most people, and what you said too, because I think most people would do this, right? They think that there's like, oh, I've got to find these like certain mispricings in the market.
The reason why I asked that is because people have asked me, how do you do this?
Right. So in the world of options, and I'll tell you how it is on my end. And just as background, as a company, we've backtested 21 million different strategies, right? So like when I say this stuff, it's not theory. Like we have numbers and data to support this. That's taken years to like backtest all these strategies on almost all possible conceivable indexes and ETFs and Google and Apple. And so we've got all the data to kind of back up what I'm going to say here. But the reality is that there's no like one little edge that you can find all the time. So everyone's looking for like, oh, what's the mispricing in this security? Or what's the mispricing in this security? And for the most part, if you're looking at liquid markets, which is what you really should be looking at, there's really not too many mispricings in those options. Mm-hmm. Where the edge comes in is in the fact that volatility is always overstated long-term. And what I mean by that, and I hope people really understand this, is that if you look at an option contract on, let's say, Apple, and the options market is assuming that Apple moves 30% over the next year. Well, when we actually go back and retroactively track how much Apple moved over that year, maybe Apple only moved 25%. I mean, it's still a big move, but it didn't move 30%. Mm-hmm. And so that difference is the difference that people should be really looking toward. That is your edge, is in that overpricing of options long-term. And that edge, you know, literally plays out over lots of trades and over long periods of time. It may not happen the first month, right? So if the market's expecting Apple to move up 5% this month, maybe it moves 7%. But long term, it always is going to overstate or overshoot that move. And really what it comes down to is that people are always more, you know, fearful or more greedy on both ends, and the market ends up being somewhere in the middle all the time.
Is it also because of how the pricing is done by the, we'll call it the players that are issuing these, that a lot of times they're offering these and they're going to put a little padding in for themselves on the volatility?
I don't think that they put a padding in. I think it's just naturally happening. I mean, like you could say, okay, maybe in some instances, maybe the market makers kind of pad the pricing a little bit, or the exchanges pad the pricing. But the end result is that there still has to be a buyer and a seller on every end. And so you have people on both ends that are truly anticipating, you know, X move in the security. And we all do this. I mean, we do this in our own lives. Like we think our house is worth more than we could probably really sell it for, right?
No, not
we
me. Think mine's worth more.
Right. So like, and we think like in every instance, or like we think our kids are probably smarter than maybe they really are, like whatever the kid. And I've got two girls.
Yeah,
I mean, they're geniuses.
Brilliant. Yeah.
They're brilliant kids. Yeah. They're 2.5 and doing Mozart and all that stuff. But you know what I mean? Like we always overshoot. We always think things are going to be worse than they actually are. And so it's just a natural, you know, thing that happens. And like I said, I mean, we've tested this across like 225, 226 different securities, every conceivable market now, every index, every international, national, like it all ends up working out about the same all the time, that it always overshoots on both ends.
Let's get back to the 21 million number. Is that an exaggeration, or is that really, what is that?
I'm legit telling you that's 21.
What does that even mean? I don't even know what that means.
Okay. So if we had, let's say we tested SPY, which is the S&P 500 ETF, and we tested a strangle on SPY 30 days out with a 30 delta and taking profits at, you know, 10% of premium and having a stop loss and then filtering all those trades by IV rank, right? So that's five different variables there. We've literally gone and changed every single variable in there to have multiple different combinations. So like in the case of SPY, just testing a strangle in SPY, we could be looking at 140,000 different variations of one strategy in one ETF.
Because of pricing and then changing the various volatility ratios and all this stuff, right?
Exactly, right? Yeah. So we look at a strategy that's 10 days out, then we do the same thing and we change the strategy from, okay, not the 10-day out options, but the 30-day, and then we change it to the 60. And then we do all that over again, and then we look at DIA and Apple and Tesla and Google, and we do all of that in combination. It ends up being right now, and we're still doing more, it's about 21 million, a little over 21 million different strategies that we've tested.
And so again, what was the end result of this extraordinary, exhaustive testing of these various, well, you know, just take one of them, for example, you know, what was your end? Okay. I figured out that.
So one, there's pockets.
Yeah, what's that?
There's pockets. Yeah, there's okay. What I call it, there's pockets, right? Like, so it would be completely irrational of me to say that there's one perfect strategy, right? Yeah. So there's pockets of strategies that work. The main threads that I see that continue to be played out in a lot of this testing that we're doing is, one, you have to really be an option seller long term. And I'm not knocking the guys who are option buyers. Yeah. I'm just saying long term, if you really want to like play the income game versus the, you know, home run game, you got to be an option seller.
And by the way, that ties out to what I said earlier about the padding. I'm just saying it just ties out to that ties out to the fact of what you said is that this extra volatility that's assumed. So therefore, what you're getting as a seller is the volatility compression.
The differential. Yep. Okay. Exactly.
Yep.
You're getting that long term. So that's one of the major themes that like absolutely played out. The other major theme that played out is that being an option seller always works, but it really works when volatility is over, like when volatility is really high. So like in market, I mean, like usually market crashes. What we recently saw in gold, where gold actually kind of like crashed up, but it had a huge move up. And that expanded volatility, that edge that you get is much wider, much bigger, whatever you want to call it, when volatility is high and at its peak. So like around earnings season, the Brexit vote was a great example of that just recently. So that's where that kind of peaks out. And then the other thing that we see is that it doesn't matter what security we're trading. I mean, literally the same clusters of strategies that work out really well are found in every type of different market, like emerging markets, Brazil, Russia, the FTSE, like it doesn't matter the market. It's the same cluster of, you know, strategies that tend to work out. Could maybe one strategy work a little bit different in Apple than Google? Yeah, but the same philosophy of option selling, let's say 30 days out using a strangle, works out pretty well, right?
Yeah, so that's what. But one of the problems and one of the challenges I have right now with a lot of things is, you know. And I'm not really necessarily knocking what you did, and I'm not at all, actually.
No, go ahead.
The thing is that, you know, you started back in 2007, okay? The world since 2007, and yes, there was 2008 in there, and I know we had that correction, all that stuff, and all that went down, I get that. But just giving you a little bit of an older guy's kind of backward-looking view from this. The volatility has been compressing since then. Yeah, we had a couple of spikes of volatility here and there. Well, clearly in 2008, but beyond that, I'm talking beyond that point. You know, for the last however many years, it would, first of all, buy every dip that you could find. It doesn't matter if it's a 5-minute dip or a 5-day dip. Okay, just buy it, which also means, you know, sell volatility, right? The second thing is that we're in a situation where everything is supported unnaturally by the Fed and by various other players out there around the world. Sovereign wealth funds and governments. And I just wonder when and if, this is probably the if is more important, if there's a change back to what the old days were, and that was also a time, just as a point of reference, that was a time where things weren't as efficient as they are today, right? So maybe back in 2004, if we were sitting right here, you and I right now, you would not be able to bring me that 21 million number.
Right.
Because if you did, you'd be like on, okay, we're in variation number 7 right now. And it's taken us 2 years. You know what I'm saying? And,
It wouldn't have been as easy. Yeah.
Right. So what I'm saying though is I find that some of the things that have been working which are very obvious, and I get what you're saying totally, 100%. I just wonder if we go back to a normal market, which again, I don't know if that's, maybe it's normal now. Maybe that's what it is. This is it.
The new normal.
Yeah. Maybe this is, this is what's going to be for the future. I don't know. I mean, this is what it's going to be. It just seems very unnatural to me, but maybe, I try to block what happened before, just, okay, let's look what's happening now and look ahead. Because you don't want to get mired in that whole situation of what happened before, if you will, right? Whether it's the 50s, the 60s, 70s, kind of like what's the new. I just wonder if the same kind of thing would work, and if you have to then, and maybe it is. Maybe it's this volatility is always overstated, which I think is a key component of what you're talking about. But I just wonder if we brought this forward, if it would be. Do you have that same concern?
So I always think that the markets are going to change, right? Like, I mean, as new technology comes out, I think as more and more high frequency trading firms come out, I actually think that what it becomes, so like most people, I assume, and this is my own like theory on this, is that most people would assume that like with a lot of these high frequency trading firms, that the market's going to be more erratic. We're going to have more flash crashes. But the reality is that whatever company like, executed the flash crash or whatever that ended up being, right? Because I don't think anyone really, really knows like what it was. There's probably another firm that has an algorithm that identifies that and trades against it, right? So I think the more that that happens, then the less latency there is in the market and, everything becomes less and less volatile. So I do think that, we're going to see continued contractions in volatility. But even going back even further, I mean, we tested SPY and DIA back into the 80s. I mean, the options data was very, not as liquid as it was today. But mm-hmm. even back then, we had same instances where implied volatility was overstated. And that was in the early 80s through the 90s into the 2000s. So most of the data that we have is into the early 2000s, which encompasses a pretty good span of time, but it doesn't all go back to the 80s, right? Like Facebook wasn't around in the 80s, but a lot of that stuff still works out. So I think it'll still play out in the future, even if it was less profitable than maybe it is today. So like under the assumption that it's less profitable 10 years from now than it is today, I still think it's a better way to go than just maybe blindly buying and holding, right? Like as just like using that as the guinea pig.
I got you.
There's a way and an opportunity to do it.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these really ridiculous names that option strategies have. We have, we have the strangle. We have the condor, the iron condor. We have, all these different, things like, just simple things like just a buying or a selling or just a selling. You get naked. I mean, you get very funky names in the option.
Yeah, we're
area.
Weird. Yeah, we're weird.
So, sure. So you said strangle. You said mm-hmm. the word strangle. Tell me, just walk me through a strangle.
Gotcha. So let's take a stock that's trading at $100. And a strangle would be a naked option strategy where you would sell a call option at a strike price above where the stock is trading. And you'd simultaneously sell the put option at a strike price below where the stock is trading. So let's take
two sells.
90. Yeah, let's say we sell a 90 strike put option and we sell a 110 strike call option. So what this is doing now is it's creating an area or profit zone between 90 and 110. So as long as the stock, which is trading at $100, stays between 90 and 110 between now and whenever your expiration is, 30 days out, 15 days out, 2 months, whatever, then you collect the entire premium that you took in for selling that strategy. Now, the opposite buyer, the buyer of the strangle, if you're going to be a seller, which I think you should be a seller for clarification, but the buyer of the strangle is going to pay me a premium. And if the stock breaks out of that zone, then I pay him some amount depending on how far it broke out of that zone. So the buyer of a strangle is really looking for that big move in either direction, and I'm looking for the stock just to stay range bound.
Now, in this particular strategy, you theoretically have unlimited losses.
Theoretically.
Right, because you're going to take in, I'm just going to pull a number up. You take in a dollar, I'm just going to say, between the two different options that you sold, you're going to take in a dollar.
And I could pay out 20.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a little bit rough, or more. You could obviously close it early if you want, buy it in, and et cetera. But so that's one thing. So that's a strangle, which obviously probably gets his name from the fact that you're being choked. You could be choked to death on this.
Exactly. Yeah. You're kind of like choking around the market. I always think like you got two hands around the market and you're forcing it to do something crazy.
Right. Yep. So then we have other things. So let's go the opposite. Let's go where you'd possibly do, let's say, a spread.
Yep, a spread. So a spread is just a variation of like taking the strangle like concept of selling options on one end and on either end, and instead just focusing on one end. So like, let's take that same $100 stock example. You could sell the 90 strike puts just like you would in a strangle. But now, because you don't want to take on that unlimited risk component, right? You say to yourself, like, look, if I sell the 90 strike puts, I don't want to protect in case this thing goes to zero, right? Like, I don't want to pay out if this thing goes to zero. So now you go in and you buy. So you use a combination of buying and selling. You buy an 85 strike put and say, you know what? I will accept the risk between 90 and 85. But below 85, I'm going to buy an option so that I'm protected or covered in case the stock really goes low, right? And right. So in this case, you take in less premium, so because you got to use a little bit of the money that you took in to buy that option and buy protection, but you're covered in risk.
So let's say that the stock is currently trading at 90. Let's just say that number, right? So maybe let's say you take in a dollar, mm-hmm. and maybe you spend 50 cents just as a number. I mean, whatever.
Yep.
And that's going to be, if it stays, you're basically locked into that, right? You can't really make anything more on that, can you? Well, I guess you're going to lose more money on that too, because the differential on the five, right?
Yeah, yeah. You would, well, if the stock is at 90 at expiration, you'd still make your 50 cents that you took in as a net credit, right?
Right, yep.
Because your break-even point is really 89.5. Right. So it's really, if the stock goes below 85, then yeah, you lose the differential between your strikes, which is $5, less the net credit that you took in. So you lose $4.50 on that trade, which is definitely less than if you did nothing at all, right? If you didn't have any protection. But you also took in less premium.
But that would be a bullish spread, obviously, right? Because you'd want it to actually move higher and you'd get all your money.
Totally bullish. And the beautiful thing about doing that, and this is why I say, like, people can do this even with a small account, IRAs, whatever. I mean, like, just try one. Try one. They're, you know, you could do them that are $1 wide. So you literally have maybe $90 of total risk. But with options, you can set your probability and say, like, look, I want to target that 90 strike. That may have a 70% chance of actually being a winning trade, because we know the probability of the stock moving. We know how far it's moved historically. We know the implied volatility. We can set a probability number to that 90 strike and say, you know what? There's probably about a 30% chance it trades below here. So a 70% chance that it trades above here. And that's all you care about in that instance, is the stock trading anywhere above that 90 strike.
So now if Mark, you talked about like opportunities, you talked about Brexit, you talked about, you know, stocks move higher and earnings and things like that, that nature. Is it where, for example, on the Brexit, where you have a major break and then you have volatility increases through VIX, and you could look at that and see kind of what's going on with volatility. Is it where you say, okay, at that point, I want to do like a bearish spread, for example, or that's where I'd sell a strangle? And if, in fact, we saw a big move up, for example, I don't know what that would be, but whatever it was, you know, a rocket ship up one day, you say, you know what, I'm going to, you know, buy a strangle, or I'm going to do a bearish spread. Is that kind of some of the theory?
So I think that the idea is, first, you just have to realize where volatility is. And then at that point, then it's open to your interpretation of where the market goes. And like I tell people, like, it doesn't matter what you want to do after that point. So are you bullish, like coming into the Brexit vote, to use that as our example? You're bullish? Great. Use a bullish strategy. But just make sure that you are selling options as a net basis. So whether that's selling a strangle or selling a naked put or selling a put credit spread, whatever you want to do on the bullish side, just do so with a net bias towards selling options. Sell more options than you buy is really the end result, right?
Right. So in other words, so that you're getting money in before you begin.
Correct.
Yeah, you have money in the bank before things happen.
Correct. Yeah, Warren Buffett calls it float. He loves the idea because Buffett's a huge option seller, and he uses the term float. You collect money without having to pay it out yet, potentially.
Right. And let's talk about one of the simplest option strategies that people can use. Now, one of the things that's that people can do, you know, we have a lot of clients and people that have, let's say, a position it doesn't matter the stock. Let's bring up ExxonMobil. They've had for like 700,000 years. Okay,
perfect.
It's been passed through the generations, and they got this stock, or GE for that matter. And they got a pretty significant gain in it. And they're like, you know what? I like this. I got a decent dividend from it and all that. But you know what? What if markets go down? Should I sell some? Well, like, listen, if you sell it, you got like no cost basis in this thing. You're going to be paying taxes already. We're going to clip you by whatever, 20% on capital gains. And, you know, that's a problem. So there is a protective style of having option strategy that you can utilize so that you can say, well, you know what, maybe instead of selling, you know, let's just say this, 1,000 shares, okay, of Exxon. Mm-hmm. Instead of selling, let's say 250 just to bring down your position because you're concerned about this, let's take some profits in, et cetera. There are option strategies for protection, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, like that's like what most people start doing is they start using them for protection. Here's what I'll tell you, though. In every instance that we've backtested, you just have to realize that if you do that, which is, and the, what you're trying to explain is you would buy a put option. And it's just like buying insurance on your house, right? Like if you have a house that's worth $100,000, you could take out an insurance policy worth $90,000 that says if the house burns down, this insurance policy pays me $90,000. You still took a little bit of risk on your own, like on your own, but you're thinking, look, the house is either going to burn down or it's not, right? It may not burn a little bit. And so the same thing applies with what you're talking about is that if you have this position in Exxon, you're taking out this insurance policy, you're buying a put option, which you pay a premium to buy that insurance, but that insurance kicks in at whatever strike price you determine, whatever value you determine on that policy, and it pays out anything below that number. So you're really protected from that level down. But the problem in using that, and look, I'm not knocking people for using it. I'm not telling you don't use it. I'm just saying realize what you're doing. You are truly paying for insurance protection. So if you do that, it never works out on a consistent basis. If you wanted to do that, and if you wanted to do it, I would say do it sparingly during certain times of the year. Maybe,
right.
You know, if you think something's going to happen weird this quarter.
Well,
if
you keep on buying insurance and it expires, like term insurance, right? For life insurance. If you keep on buying insurance and it expires before you die, all you do is pay premiums on it.
Exactly. So just realize you can do that.
There's other things there's other things like collars.
I was just going to say the other one you could do is the costless collar, right? And I say if you're going to do anything, do the costless collar. Now, if you do the costless collar, you're selling a call option, and let's say you take in 50 cents of premium, and that 50 cents that you took in, you use that credit, that 50 cents, to buy a put option. So you're financing the purchase of that put option. Now, at this point, you should theoretically do it for no cost or very close to no cost. And now you're not going to have the same type of protection in the sense that you're not going to have like this unlimited protection that really kicks in, like this juicy, like, you know, really good insurance policy, but it will, you know, kind of hedge your bets a little bit. And so that's one way, like I tell people, if you want to do that, do the costless collar, don't do the single put option.
Yep. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, we talked about a variety of different trades, buying or selling a put. And obviously if you go quote unquote naked, you're going to have unlimited up to, you know, generally speaking, unlimited loss potential. If you do things like a strangle, you know, you can also, depending on how you set it up, you can have unlimited. You have things like collars we talked about, which obviously you're going to do costless, or maybe other types of spreads where you can actually keep a very defined range of risk on your option. And again, you know, you have to look in how long you go out and what you're doing with this and all. We talked about the different theta, beta, delta, gamma, all that stuff. I know that you also educate and you tell me how your whole Option Alpha deal works. What is the blog? What is it? Explain this to me.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the deal, right? Like everyone out there, and this is a pet peeve of mine since I started back in 2007. And the end result is that so many companies out there, and still to this day, I don't freaking get it for like the love of me, but they charge people for the education portion of what they do. And so my thought has always been, I'm never going to charge people for education. So we've got, I think, some of the best training. I know people have gone through this that are multi-millionaires and that have been through all kinds of training, have been in hedge funds, worked for hedge funds, built models for hedge funds, and they still tell us like our training is some of the best training out there in options. It's totally 100% free. All we ask is you just sign up for a free membership. That's it. So you can have a free membership for as long as you want. You can access everything for as much as you want. If and only if you think that our training's good and if you wanted to see what we trade on a daily basis before everyone else sees it, then you could sign up for like a pro or an elite membership or whatever the case is, right? And so like my model has always been that I still publish all of my trades 20 days after they go out to our elite members. And so everything else is out there on YouTube. I do a video every single night. I'm pretty sure, and less more people have started doing this in the last 2 days, I'm the only guy in the options trading industry that publishes a video every single day that I make a trade. So if I don't make a trade on Monday, I don't publish the video. But if I make two trades on Tuesday, I record my screen. I walk through the entire trade. I tell you why I did it, what it, like the whole deal, and I publish it on YouTube. It's for my members first, who pay to get access to that first. And then it goes public, and I'm the only guy who does it. So the model is this. You come in, you learn everything there is to learn. You don't need to sign up for any further options trading, you know, like membership. You don't need to upgrade to pro or elite to learn everything. I am 100% open as to like, this is how we do it. This is the numbers. Here's the back testing. Here's the this. You can do it by yourself in that sense. And I think a lot of people do that. If you need the extra handholding and you want like group coaching and stuff like that, okay, yeah, then it's going to cost you a little bit because that's more of my time. And so that's really the model.
That's like the new recipe models. I'm not making light of it. I think it's good. So a lot of times you saw these guys on YouTube or wherever it is, like doing a recipe. You know, they show you the recipe, right? Here's how we cook it. Here's how we do it. Here's how we, you know, do this whole thing. And it was like kind of they gave you everything. And okay, great. No, but now, you know, they didn't give you all of it. It was kind of like, okay, well, dude, how much salt did you put in there? You know, I mean, you know, what, where did you get this? How much did you? And then what they do a lot of these ones is, hey, here's the whole recipe. We're going to do it for you. I'm going to show you. But if you want all the details of all the different things that we did, just sign up for a membership, pay us a couple of bucks, and we'll give you like, you know, this 3 teaspoons of this, a half a teaspoon of that. We got this brand of that. You know, this is how we package it all together, et cetera. So anyway,
Totally not what we do. Just to be clear, totally not what we do. People come in and they're like, hey, where's the extra video tutorials when they sign up? And I'm like, there's no extra video tutorials.
No, I got it. I was just saying that I was comparing it, not. Identifying it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, you know, so like, let me rephrase it. So if they need an extra hand holding, if somebody needs somebody to help them learn how to chop or whatever, I don't know, whatever. And I'm talking about the recipes, but maybe a bad example, but sorry.
Brought it up. Well, anyway. Hey, we're doing strangles and straddles. So we could be chopping things up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, hopefully not getting chopped up yourself. So anyway, this is Kirk Duplessis, and you got to go over to Option Alpha, and I'll show you that where that is to be found on the show notes of this episode. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You have a Twitter account. How can people follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, everything's at Option Alpha. So Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Periscope, the whole deal.
Option Alpha. All right, we'll get this to everybody because I think there's going to be a lot of interest in this. I really thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks. That was some great information. I mean, I know that a lot of times the whole idea of options is confusing, and it's for a lot of reasons, as we've talked about right now. But in the end, I guess, you know, when you look at the, break it down to some of its easiest and most basic formulas and look at this as a way to, you know, understand this. And the thing that utilizing the various spreads and strangles and the things we talked about, and there's a lot more than that, of course, there's a very clear understanding of what the potential profit or loss potential is. And you can set that up in advance and is very much identified before you actually enter the trade. So, and also the other thing about options is that you use less money than you would to buy the same amount of stock because it's leveraged. So anyway, you can go over to disciplinedinvestor.com and check that out and find out where you can find more about Option Alpha. All right. One of the things I wanted to mention this week happened. There's a few things that happened this week that are pretty crazy. One of the things that happened this week happened at the end of the week, and it was this whole continuation of the Herbalife saga with Bill Ackman, who is short and is like his lifetime goal to break this company, to say that, yes, this is a multi-level Ponzi / bad deal. Right? This is a pyramid operation. This Herbalife is bad. Now he got actually, which it seemed to me that he got a thumbs up from the feds when they had fined HLF $200+ million for their business practice and made them change their entire business practice. And then this week though, let's kind of fast forward because nothing really happened with the stock. This week he comes on and puts out some kind of a note, and I guess CNBC picks it up, that Jefferies, a brokerage firm, was shopping a major block of HLF, was shopping to sell a major block. And he made the interpretation and made it sound like it was Carl Icahn's block that he was looking to move. And they approached Ackman to actually buy some of it. Why Ackman would buy it, except for trying to get Carl Icahn out of the story, I don't know. But, you know, because he's short. So it comes out that, okay, there's a big block, somebody's shopping it. Why would anybody that is in the brokerage side of things leak this information first of all? Because that would not help their situation to try and unload this block. And, you know, 2.5 million shares, something like that. And then on top of it, you know, Ackman comes out and then without full knowledge thinks and presumes that it was Icons. Maybe somebody told him that. Maybe it was Icons. It's possible. Stock drops about 6%. It's down throughout the day on Friday. Thinking that, hey, Icons out of this, because that's this kind of headline, the storyline. After the close on Friday, Carl Icahn comes out with a scathing letter against Ackman, saying, hey, you don't know what my position is. You don't know what the story is. And we still support the company. And they bought 2.5 million shares of the company throughout the day on Friday, adding to their position. So I don't know. And the stock was up like 6% after hours. So I don't know if Icahn is kind of playing poker, you know, bluffing and putting his shares out there and waiting for somebody to bite and make it look like he's selling and then drop the stock down and just going in and buying more. Or if this is just a vendetta, if this is just a game to break the back of Bill Ackman, who he has sparred with on this HLF for a long time. Remember, if you have enough money, you can move a stock pretty significantly. And with a name like Icahn, who is able to put a lot of money into this, it seems that, you know, this is what he's doing. So first of all, let me say, well played by Icahn. Makes Ackman look like an idiot. Because one, if the shares were not Icons truly, well, he looks like an idiot for saying it. Number two, if he was suckered in by Icahn, he looks like an idiot. And number three, the stock is up substantially after the close, which makes him look like an idiot for shorting this to begin with. I still believe that Herbalife is a long-term potential short. I don't hold a position for any of our accounts. We actually have a short position in the game we play on DH Unplugged each and every week. The weekly stock picks game, we're short Herbalife. I'm short Herbalife. But this whole thing is pretty, it's pretty entertaining. I guess it is definitely entertaining, if nothing else. And then, by the way, we'll kind of quickly go to the other story of the week, which was Mylan, which has the EpiPen that raised the price. And then Hillary Clinton comes out with a scathing commentary about these companies. The company drops and they come out with some cockamamie discussion about how they're going to give a coupon or some kind of a credit back to the end users and this and that. But when you look at this, obviously Hillary Clinton is not dropping her promise to really do something about the incredible rate hikes and the hikes in the cost of to the consumer of these various drugs. And Mylan just waved it right in front of her face. And she just took her shot. So now we have this whole biotech situation starting to all of a sudden look concerning once again. And it's probably going to prompt some level of volatility, to say the least, in the biotech stocks. And Mylan is looking pretty bad right now, even after the CEO came on a variety of different news outlets, business news outlets. I think it was on CNBC and Bloomberg, and I think maybe, possibly Fox. I don't remember if it was Fox. But I think it was on definitely CNBC I watched because I thought it was so, again, entertaining. But it was interesting that she really didn't give any clarification because the question kept being asked, why are you raising rates and why not just reduce the rates? And one of the things that's the most troubling about this whole news story that how it transpired was Mylan put out this rate increase or the price increase of the EpiPen. And then 2 days later, I think it was that Hillary Clinton comes out with her comment. And then a day later, they come and they say, oh, yeah, we're gonna do something to reduce the price. They look pretty bad at this point, don't they? In other words, they were trying to sneak in this rate increase or this, I keep saying rate increase, but this price increase. And then they oh, sorry about that. We didn't realize it would offend you. We're going to back off. And this discussion of how there's so many hands that touch the pricing model of any of these drugs that was brought out by the CEO of Mylan saying that how the system is broken and they just operate within the system didn't make them look good, but also brought to light the fact that there is something very broken with the system. How they can't reduce the price on it outright, they have to give some kind of a coupon. And what is that coupon going to do? Is it going to actually or a credit or some kind of how is this going to work? It's going to be a margin squeeze, isn't it? Something doesn't add up with this whole thing. It stinks to high hell. The whole biotech and healthcare market stinks to high hell. Let's be honest about it. Now, there's some great breakthroughs out there. No question about that. But this whole game of increasing the price on a regular basis, just sneaking it up and sneaking it up and sneaking it up, especially for a drug that's proven and that has distribution, is just atrocious. It is greedy and absolutely intolerable, because you and I are paying for this in all sorts of ways. So we're going to watch Mylan over the next few weeks, and obviously the entire ETF universe for related to biotechs, right? You know, anything that's related to biotechs and healthcare, going to see some movements there, and probably a lot of action and volatility. Anyway, on that note, we're going to end. As I mentioned, you can follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com is where you can get me, also an email. And other than that, I think we're done for the week. I'll see you soon. Listen to DH Unplugged, of course, each and every Tuesday night with myself and John C. Dvorak. We'll talk next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.